Quickly and easily deliver Jakarta EE apps in any environment, on-premise, in the cloud, or hybrid. Pyera Platform Enterprise is a stable, supported open framework optimized for containerized Jakarta EE and microprofile applications. Learn more at pyera.fish.
Good day, folks. This is Shane Hasty for the InfoQ Engineering Culture Podcast. I'm at Agile 2019 in Washington, D.C., and I'm sitting down with Em Campbell-Pretty. Em, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me, Shane.
Now, you and I have known each other for, a decade or so, I suppose.
About that. I think we met one of these events, somebody's room, maybe drinking something. Anyway.
It's possible. Yep. It's distinctly possible. But I suspect that a fair number of our audience haven't come across you before. So would you mind a brief background and introduction?
I primarily work with Scaled Agile Framework. Mm-hmm. That's probably what I'm best known for. Mm-hmm. I'm a safe fellow. Apparently there's only 16 of us, so that's
fairly prestigious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Only two women. Someone told me a safe fellowess. So that kind of means I've been doing this safe thing a long time. My claim to fame and my introduction to that world was launching Australia's first implementation of safe, which was at Telstra in early 2012, before it was called the Scaled Agile Framework. So what we had done at the time was read a couple of books by Dean Leppingwell and decided that was going to solve our scaling woes, and launched an agile release train, and it did solve our scaling woes. I had a lot of fun with that, and we had a lot of fun transforming our culture. So off the back of that, I went on to start my own business, which I named after my blog, which is Pretty Agile. Been writing and launching trains and having fun and changing cultures ever since.
Writing. You've got one book. Tell us about that one.
And my book is Tribal Unity. It was released on the 27th of October 2016. Isn't it funny how you remember those things? In Denver, Colorado. My book is really about cultural change. One of the things I've found over the years is if you change the culture, the rest will come. So I had the great fortune, or misfortune, as it may be, to work with an organisation where we had about 150 people who didn't know each other's names, but they'd been working together for about 5 years. When we went to Agile at first, that was still the case. They were kind of all independent Agile project teams, and then I started playing with the Agile release train, and we started working on how do we create team of team culture. Mm-hmm. So you think most Agilists, we know team, 7 ± 2, give them a name, take them out to lunch every week, do some bonding. How do we do that to 10 teams that all need to be one team? So that is the premise of the book. So sometimes think of it as scaling culture, because we're so good at that team level culture, and how do we scale that to team of teams? Just based on a whole heap of patterns that I've used over the years. It's interesting, people are really quick to go, well, that's a technology thing. And I said, actually, you should probably just have a look at that book, because I'm pretty sure there's one mention of technology which says if you're going to do software development, you should use XP. That's good advice. Everything else, in all the patterns in that book, will apply to any type of organisation doing any type of activity. So I even just had a chat with someone earlier today at the conference who said exactly that thing to me. You know, that all works for software, but what about legal and HR? And I said, guess what? It all works for legal and HR too. If we can form solid teams, create connections among those teams, right leadership behaviours, right leadership mindset, we can make a difference. So possibly it's because I come from a different world, I see it a little bit differently. So unlike most folks, I don't come from a technology background, I come from a business background. So I think what people often, they hear me talk and they go, oh, that's what we do with technical agile. And I go, well, that's nice. I don't come from that world, and that's what I do too.
So at the conference, you've given a couple of talks, learning from the books you said you read. Ooh, embarrassing. How many of these books are on our bookshelves that we haven't actually read yet?
We took a poll at the beginning of the talk. We established that we had a room full of people with guilty consciences who had come to work out how to solve for. We go to conferences, we collect names of books. We can now buy them instantly online with our Kindles. But, you know, do we actually read them? And if we read them, do we do anything with that reading? So I had a bit of a premise over the years. In fact, I started telling you about it just before. When I started doing Scaled Agile, I'd read a couple of books because there was no scaledagileframework.com. There was no leading safe, implementing safe and whatever other classes. There were just these books. We slowed the conversation right down and we ran book clubs where we took a chapter a week, read the chapter, discussed the chapter. Do we like this idea? Do we implement it? Do we like this idea, but we need to change it and implement it, or do we not like this idea? Mm-hmm. So very, very deliberate about learning, very, very action-oriented mm-hmm. in our learning. Mm-hmm. And it became part of the culture that we have at Pretty Agile. We read books, and then we run experiments mm-hmm. based on the ideas that we liked. Mm-hmm. So we thought that might be interesting to people. Part of my premise was, when I read a book and don't take action, I know I've read it, but I can't remember it. Mm-hmm. When I read a book and do something with it, and that something can be I use it to teach, I use it to run a workshop, I do whatever it says, then I remember it. So if I want to retain my learning, I've got to have a bias to action mm-hmm. about how I read. So that was the journey that we took that group on yesterday afternoon. I shared with them some books that we'd read, most of which they hadn't read, so they got a few extras out of that as well, and got them thinking about what they were going to do after this conference in terms of not just writing down the names of books or buying the books, but actually reading the books and then taking an action based on that.
And your other talk, is there a place for individuals in enterprise agility?
I hope so.
Maybe.
Maybe.
There's something about individuals and interactions in a manifesto
somewhere. I heard that somewhere, yeah. I think for me, the space of enterprise agile and scaling agile seems to be a space of frameworks. So there's this framework, there's that framework, this person's mm-hmm. method, and then there's the build your own framework, and then there's the various big consulting shops with their various approaches. And I'm not sure any of that's actually helping us. Mm-hmm. So the other sort of observation is the bigger the enterprise, the more we seem to lose focus on the individual mm-hmm. and the individual connection. Mm-hmm. So the conversation we were having earlier today with that group was really about one that says, can we have agility without respect for people? And what does respect for people look like? A lot of the conversation was about the economic benefit of respect for people. So what an enterprise is like is economic benefits. Mm-hmm. So while I think we know a lot of things around it's important to communicate and it's important to train people and it's important to have cadences and collaboration and all these things, but why is that good and how does that help our enterprise? Well, they all have economic benefits. So that was the little thread we were trying to draw through for people earlier today. Mm-hmm. Respect for people, it's a leadership choice, and it's a good economic choice.
Mm-hmm. But what does respect for people look like in an enterprise context?
We actually started by talking about what it doesn't look like. And are we good at talking about what things don't look like as opposed to what they do look like? So Brené Brown's session in Melbourne on Friday, she starts with, we ask people what vulnerability looks like and they tell us what it doesn't look like. So, of course, that's not what I'm going to do. So it doesn't look like people working on 5, 6, 7, 8 projects or 5, 6, 7, 8 teams. It doesn't look like you will go and do this method and you don't need any training because we can't afford that. And it doesn't look like we have an offshore team, but you know, they're the offshore team, so we don't really worry about including them in things. So it doesn't look like a two-class society. So what organizations do differently is they create a culture where there is no second-class citizens. That if you do have a distributed organisation, that there is compromise on both sides. Some people come in early, some people stay up late. We deliberately make time for connection. We prioritise making time for connection over getting the next amazing product out the door. Because just a little bit of time, just an hour, a week, a sprint, a month, creates some human connection between people. Organisations run on networks. We want to go faster. We want to increase speed to market. If we don't have the social network, if we don't have the social fabric, we can't do that. So we invest in learning, we invest in innovation, we invest in people, we create the right environment.
Sounds good.
Yeah, not sold?
Well, maybe I'm sold. Do the shareholders like it?
I didn't ask the shareholders. Look, I think for me, it's I don't like to say leap of faith stuff, but I don't know that I have a better word for it. One of the things that we do is we suggest organisations use innovation time. So carve 10% out of every sprint across every team and give it back to the team. And so you can use that time any way you want, as long as you're using it to get better as a team or as a broader enterprise. So you can work on technical debt. You can go and learn something new. You can start a book club. You can go to the Gemba and see how your customers are using your product. You can do anything that will make you better. And absolutely, people ask me, but how do I pay for that? Well, you build it into your operating model, because the payback is so significant. How do you prove that before you do it? I don't know. But you can always run an experiment. So it's not that you have to say, as of tomorrow, my entire enterprise is going to take 10% of their time and put it in improvement. We can pick a group, we can pick a department, we can say we're going to do this for a month, we're going to do this for a quarter, and then we can try it. I've never had anybody try it and not say it has benefit. And it's as simple as anything you do to get better is going to start to improve your throughput, you shorten your lead time. It's win-win. And people like to work in environments where they have that freedom. So we're now starting to get to employee retention, places people like to work, attracting talent. So it's quite a compelling economic story, in my view.
Cycling back around, you're a safe fellow.
Yes.
One could do all sorts of puns.
But I know, it's not good, is it?
Safe is the framework everybody in the agile industry loves to hate.
It is, isn't it? It certainly is. I have such strong memories of being at this conference in 2013, and that was the year that Ken Schwaber isn't here, but tweets into the Alliance tweets stream, unsafe at any speed, and then David Anderson, who's also not here, is tweeting into the tweet stream his blogs. And it's interesting for me, because I didn't grow up in software and I didn't grow up in agile. And I'm going, isn't this a people-centric movement? Isn't this about respect for people and individuals and interactions? And what is going on here? So, yes, it certainly does seem to be the framework that people love to hate.
Why is that?
I don't really know. And maybe I'm naive. I grew up in enterprise agile, right? I didn't grow up in team-level agile. I grew up in enterprise agile. So from day one, I was playing with agile at scale. I was looking for answers. I found some books. I had a lot of success. And it's been a repeated pattern. And I never went and looked for anything else. So I kind of live in that bubble. I think it's got an interesting business model sitting behind it. I think people don't necessarily appreciate that business model. I don't know that it would necessarily be my choice, but it's not my business model. So I think, you know, if you compare to Scrum, it's created, it's free. And then there is the way that Scrum was monetized, as I understand it, is 200 odd people are allowed to train Scrum Masters. And, you know, SAFE took a very different tact. It created a train-the-trainer program out of the gate, and anyone who takes that class and passes an exam can teach a class. So I think there's got to be at least part of this that says there's an economic model for a group of people on one side that another group of people are threatening, and I can certainly understand how uncomfortable that would be. So I think that's got to be part of it. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there. Almost any time I get into a conversation with someone about why they dislike SAFE, they almost always tell me something that isn't true. Why is that so? I don't know. I think probably the existence of the big picture is SAFE. So scaleagileframework.com and the big diagram, I think it's strength and it's weakness. It's an incredibly comprehensive body of knowledge, a set of proven patterns that have been used that are free and accessible, and it's an extremely large body of knowledge that people find it difficult to consume and can easily misinterpret if they're not actually going to take the time to dig in. So I think it's an interesting challenge. As I said, for me, I had a lot of success. I've continued to have a lot of success with it, and I've very much taken to heart the part of SAFE that says our values are lean. So respect for people, relentless improvement, foundation is leadership, focus on flow, focus on innovation, the goal is the delivery of value. If that's my core value set, I don't know how wrong I can go. Does everyone hear that message? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly for me. I can look at SAFE, I can look at that very core lean value set and go, that's all right with me. I can certainly help people using that.
I've heard SAFE compared to the RUP. It's RUP reborn. And yet, I also happen to know Philippe Christian quite well and others of the RUP authors. And Philippe, in a conversation, made it very clear to me and explained exactly how the RUP itself was designed to be a framework that you removed stuff from and distilled it down to the minimum that you need.
Yeah.
But nobody got that message, and the consultant sold the whole thing and didn't bear it down. Is SAFE suffering from the same
interesting
mistake?
So,
not mistake, the same misinterpretation?
Could well be. So I didn't grow up in technology, I didn't grow up with RUP either, I know of it. Certainly the message in SAFE, probably stronger in the earlier days in some ways. They used to talk about scale up, so add what you need, and the messaging in the how the framework was taught was scale up. The language they use now is they talk a lot about essential SAFE. An essential SAFE is the Agile release train, the team of Agile teams. And at its heart, that's all SAFE is. The team of Agile teams work together to solve a problem. I think that the more recent releases of SAFE have tried to clarify that this is a core piece and add what you need. I do think that there's a lot of things on that framework, and I do think it's easy for people to over-engineer it. I feel like it's trending away from that, but I've certainly, at a point in time going back a couple of years, I felt like everyone was trying to over-engineer their organisation and taking really tiny organisations that were a single Agile release train and trying to apply a whole heap of concepts that just don't make sense or are necessary in that size of organisation. I'm seeing less of that now than I was 2 years ago, and I think SAFE's done a good job in the last couple of years of trying to illustrate configurability in a better way. But, you know, of course, that's the last couple of years, and we're talking about a framework that's been around since 2012 and grown over that time. It started smaller and it got bigger.
The diagram is imposing.
It is, it's rather large, isn't it? Yeah. We call it the big picture.
So, what's good about SAFE?
For me, it's been an opportunity to create better working cultures, to create environments that people want to be a part of. So everywhere I've managed to work with SAFE, we've managed to completely change how people feel about where they work. And it's kind of awesome, right? Take 100 people, a couple of hundred people, 500 people, 1,000 people, and change their lives, because we spend so much time at work. So that's certainly what drives me. That's certainly been my experience with SAFE. I can't talk for everybody else, but I think it's awesome. They're getting better throughput, happier people, where they're working with software, they're getting better quality code. They're getting results. Is it all answers to all things for all people? Probably not. Has it helped organisations that I've seen struggling perform better? Yes, and often in ways that quite surprise me. I find organisations that go, oh, you're kind of small, you're sure you need this? And then you spend time with them and you see that, you know, communication and alignment's a problem, code quality's a problem, all these things that we can actually address because we have this very comprehensive set of tools that play together. So I think it helps. Is it magic? No. Is it for everybody? Maybe not. But have I had success with it? Yes. Have my clients had success with it? Yes. And, you know, I'm all for anything that works.
Em, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. It's
no problem.
Been really good, and good to hear the alternate view.
Two sides to every story.
There are indeed. So if people want to continue the conversation, where do they find you?
Prettyagile.com is probably the best way to find me.
And we'll put that link in the show notes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I'm sitting down with Greg Koberger. Greg is the founder of ReadMe. Greg, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So ReadMe, there are lots and lots of files that I've seen that have had that word in it, but I suspect you don't quite mean the same as what Microsoft does with their installation of whatever software. So tell me a bit about ReadMe and about yourself, please.
So I think most of your audience is probably familiar with README Files. So my friends from high school know what I do. They know they're my company, but that's about all they know. And they were watching Mr. Robot a few months ago, and I got a bunch of texts from them. And they're like, I can't believe your company was on Mr. Robot. And I was like, because I saw, like, you know, on the command line, you know, he was editing a README file. And they're like, I can't believe he was using your company on the show. And I was like, oh, not quite. So yes, we were inspired by README Files, which come with pretty much every software package, whether it be, you know, a Microsoft something or an open source tool and all that. We were looking for a name, and readme.io was available. So we nabbed that and kind of went with it. But yeah, we do, much like README Files, we do technical documentation. Our niche recently has been APIs specifically, but we're kind of a home for any sort of technical documentation. We tend to live at like developer.whatever.com. So, you know, developer.infoq.com, and we would take care of documentation, support forms, all that fun stuff.
And what brought you to where you are today? What's your background?
Great question. So my background is computer science was my major. I've always been into programming, even before that. But I kind of took a turn where I got really into design as well, specifically kind of around usability and all that. And I just fell in love with usability and design for developers. I thought it was kind of a really unique space. It's developers need a different kind of usability. They're very technical, so you can assume a lot of things, but you can't assume too many things and all that. And I just kind of like love that. And then over the past few years, I've gotten really lucky that the space has expanded. So when I started README, but even like 10 years before that, kind of when I started programming, developers were kind of their own thing. But now I've seen a change where, like, especially with APIs, the people using APIs, building on them, creating APIs, obviously a lot of developers, but there's tons of other types of people, support, marketing, product managers, who are technical or semi-technical, but not programmers. And I've kind of loved this like expansion of the space where, you know, not everyone has a CS degree in order to build something cool these days. Some of the coolest stuff's coming out of people who just toiled around in GeoCities and know enough JavaScript to be dangerous and kind of start putting stuff together. So I've kind of liked over the past few years, the shift in the type of people using technical documentation.
You started this company. One of the reasons we're on the InfoQ Culture podcast, as you put it, you want to work with people you want to work with.
Yes. So,
how do you build a culture that invites the people you want to work with?
Yeah, so I think culture is a really tough word. You talk a lot about culture. And the problem with culture is a lot of times culture can be exclusive as much as it is inclusive. And you want to make sure you're not just hiring the same people over and over again. You want to make sure that, you know, your culture is very receptive towards expansion and changing and growing as time goes on. But I still think you need some kind of core values, some core things that everyone from the get-go agrees on. And, you know, the kind of people I like working with, it's kind of a self-selecting crowd to a certain extent. And there's a few things, you know, early on that I like to do to kind of end up working with the people that I want to work with. And for the interview process, we put a lot of thought into how we want to interview. And this is mostly for technical interviews, but for any type of interview, actually. I ask two questions, but one of the questions is, what's the coolest thing you've ever built or done? For a lot of people, they'll talk about like something they did at work, a side project they worked on. Some people talk about like weird stuff that I never would have thought would be things that they would like talk about. And like, I just like people who get excited about something. It doesn't have to be about my company per se. I really enjoy working with people who are passionate and curious and like good at figuring things out. So that's kind of the one question I ask. And I kind of can get a pretty good idea if I, you know, think they're a good fit or not based on that. There's no right answer. The only wrong answer is, you know, not really having anything at all that you're kind of excited or passionate about. You know, some people just say things like they built a table or something like that, like a woodworking type thing I've had. I've had people talk about programming stuff, but I just like to see that passion with people. I think, you know, I like people who are creative, who like being self-starters, who are passionate about something. Doesn't have to be API documentation. And that's kind of people I try to attract for the most part.
And how do you prevent it becoming, as you mentioned, a monoculture, just a carbon copy of you?
That's tough because sometimes I do want things to be a copy of me because, you know, I have qualities that I like and I want everyone to have. But a lot of times I want people to push back and have different perspectives and bring different things to the table. I think it's tough. I think it involves a lot of like taking a step back and all that. And I think, you know, we do some nice things that let people kind of express things in their own way, which is nice. So like we have a mascot that's an owl and it's kind of bizarre. I wasn't planning on this. I didn't think anything of it when we started using Albert as our mascot. But it's kind of given a lot of different people a lot of different twists and ways to, you know, express themselves with making t-shirts or, you know, painting. Someone did a painting for us here. And it just kind of has been a nice way where our culture isn't based around like drinking or based around, you know, any certain one thing. You know, kind of just OWL's been taken so many different ways. Someone took us to the zoo one time. We did that as a team. Like, it kind of gives people, like, culturally, internally, a way to kind of express themselves in different ways and attracts different people. But it's tough. You know, having an OWL mascot's not the only way to, like, build a good culture. It's a balance. And so far, we've been lucky that we have a lot of really great people who are great in very different ways.
You mentioned a couple of team building things. One of the things that I know about is you're really interested in escape rooms to the point of actually building one.
Yeah, that was a little side project. So we, as a team, kind of got into escape rooms a few years ago. We do offsites all the time, and we bring people to different places. We've gone as far as like Thailand and Hawaii. Far from us, we're in San Francisco, and as close as, you know, just different cities nearby here. We've gone to the East Coast, the West Coast, all over. And we always, you know, might go to get drinks or something like that. But I wanted something that was good for people to kind of like interact and talk without having to just be a bar all the time. And we kind of got into escape rooms. And the team kind of really likes it because you spend an hour working together, uncontrived things, of course, but working together, getting to know each other, working with people that you normally wouldn't work with on the team. So we've done a bunch of escape rooms. And about 2 years ago, I got a little burnt out at work and wanted to take a week off and had to do something differently. And I rented a art gallery in San Francisco and built an escape room, like a bunch of puzzles. There's like 50 puzzles in it, and it's startup themed. And so you have an hour to launch your startup. And that's been great for other teams. We've had about 1,000 other companies come to us for team bonding events. I don't run it day to day or anything. I just kind of built it and I hired someone to run it. That has nothing to do with ReadMe. That was just like a little side project I worked on. And yeah, I think escape rooms have been really great for us to kind of get people to just really get excited about stuff.
And we'll put the link into the show notes so that people can find your escape room in San Francisco.
Perfect.
Another thing that you mentioned was the importance of physical layout, office design.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people who listen to you probably have done something similar to this, but we did a 360 thing where we had someone come in and administer it and, like, you know, asked us 100 questions or so, and they were, like, really dumb questions, or they felt dumb at the time. It was, like, you know, two adjectives, and you would pick which one you're more about, and it got a little strenuous by the end. You're just like, oh, I don't really know anymore. So I got it all done, and then you get a packet that describes you and all that. And one of the sections was about your office, your ideal office. And I read through it and I was like, this is really weird. Like, it's almost like they're messing with me. Like, it described our actual office that I had designed, like, perfectly, like brick walls, like wooden floors, you know, on the walls, like colorful posters with like values on them. Like, it was like so specific. And my point in all that is, I think that the reverse is true as well. I think that, you know, the office does a really great job of kind of helping people understand the company. It bleeds out into the product. It bleeds out into like who you hire when people come in, if they feel attracted to it or not. And I think office layout is incredibly important. Obviously, some algorithm somewhere could like describe my office to me. I think that the opposite is true, where just being in the office kind of helps set the tone and culture and all that. So we put a lot of money and time and effort into having an office that feels very like what we want it to feel like. Very homey, but also very like, you know, creative and clean and colorful and all that.
What does that mean in terms of one of the common situations we find today, like you and I are right now, is a lot of remote work.
Yep. So we're about 20% remote, give or take. We have an office in Columbus. So there's about 5 people in Columbus. And then we have a bunch of other remote people in different cities. And you're right. I don't think that you need to be in office. I think that remote work is getting bigger and bigger. And there's a lot of really great things about it. And the office doesn't really help that much for those people because, you know, they're not there. But I think, you know, we still do a lot of things, hopefully, to kind of make people feel included. We have on-sites all the time where people come here. We go to off-sites. We travel to different people's cities all the time. We send out a bunch of, like, OWL swag and stuff to people so that their offices can look like their stuff. But also, if they want to have a little Albert here or there, they can. But I agree. I don't know if it's a huge deal because I like to work from home, too, a lot, even though we have an office and all that. I think it's just nice to have, like, the headquarters or, like, the base kind of, you know, feel very ReadMe-esque.
And you use a thing called challenge coins.
Yeah.
What are they?
Are you familiar with these at all?
I've come across kudos cards.
So what a challenge coin is, it's started in the military, in the U.S. military. I'm sure it's been used otherwise. And the whole point was they would give you these coins that would say like the battalion you're on or whatever. So that if you're ever at a bar and you're like, I was in the 37th Infantry, and someone's like, no, you weren't. That's the challenge. And then you like have proof that you were in this particular battalion and things like that. And the whole thing is like, if someone challenges you on it and you pull it out, then they have to buy you a drink. And there's some other little things around it. Like, you know, you can also like take your challenge coin out and like slam it on the table. And if you do that, then everyone who has one has to do the same thing. And if everyone has it, you have to buy a round for everyone. And if someone doesn't have it, they have to buy a drink for you. So there's like some like games around and everything. And it started as a military thing. I got it from, I was listening to a podcast with a guy named Jon Favreau. He's directed a bunch of movies, like the new Lion King movie was his most recent one. But for all his movies, he'll make challenge coins and give a challenge coin to everyone who was involved in the production of the movie, from, you know, the cast and the, like, you know, really important stars all the way down to like the craft service table. And I just really liked that mentality of, it doesn't matter what you do or how involved or not involved, like everyone who was involved in this gets a challenge coin. So we started giving those out to everyone who worked at the company and who was instrumental to its success. So like investors, early people who gave like really amazing advice, friends who went like above and beyond and being supportive. And, you know, as we've gotten bigger, the bar has gotten a little bit higher to who we give it to, obviously employees. But it's been this like really fun thing that we do for everyone. And we put everyone on the website. If you go to readme.com/credits, like much like a movie credits, you can see everyone who's worked on the site. Because I think there's, you know, I get a lot of credit because it's my company, but, you know, I'm dwarfed by the just number of people who help out and work on it and work really hard. And I want a nice place for people to kind of like, you know, no one's going to really go through it and look through it just like movie credits. But I want to acknowledge like all these awesome people that helped me and the company get where we are today. So between the challenge coins, the credits, we try to like copy movies a little bit in that sense.
So where else do you draw inspiration from?
So everyone who starts the company, I give them the same book. Are you familiar with Getting Real or Rework? They're from 37 Signals, which is now called Basecamp. Mm-hmm. They also started like Ruby on Rails, and they write a few books. They've got like 5 books now. They have one, Remote Work. They have one called It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy, which you can kind of assume what that means. And I give everyone that book, and I write them a note in the beginning. I give them Rework and write a note. And I think tries to set the tone for how I look at building a product and company and a culture. Now, one of their big things is not raising money. They're very anti-VC. We've always had some VCs in the past. We just raised a big round very recently. So we're a little bit different than them, but I still love the way they think about it. Just things like, you know, you don't have to work crazy hours. You don't have to have tons of meetings. You know, the product should be driven by feeling as opposed to like customer driven, things like that. So I think it's a good way to start everyone off. I drew a bunch of inspiration for it, which is why I give everyone the book, because it's kind of a way to kind of understand how I want to think about building a company. And it's an easy read, so anyone out there should definitely read it. It's just a collection of blog posts, honestly, so you can like skip around and all that. So it's a pretty easy read.
And again, we'll include the links in the show notes.
Sound good.
Greg, so if people want to continue the conversation, where do they find you?
Twitter's a great place. ReadMe is the company account, and mine is G Koberger, G-K-O-B-E-R-G-E-R. If you have any questions, I'm also G Koberger at Gmail, G Koberger pretty much every site, not a lot of other G Kobergers out there, so I've got the social media handle everywhere. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Greg, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.